Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to the Talking Information Center Network. I'm Laura Kerrigan, your volunteer reader. Today is Monday, August 24th, 2026, and here's your news from USA Today. Our first story, no age limit on adventure. At 85, traveling nanas have visited over 50 countries on all seven continents. This is written by Kathleen Wong. Ellie Hamby and Sandy Hazlip have seen the northern lights in Finland, sailed down the Amazon River at night, and ridden the Trans-Siberian Railway, and they did it all in their 80s. Hamby and Hazlip are the 85-year-old best friend duo behind the popular TikTok account at Around the World at 80, which has over 110,000 followers. Calling themselves the Traveling Nanas, the Texas-based women chronicle their travels around the world as octogenarians, showing how their age doesn't stop them from exploring the furthest corners of the globe. In fact, their many years of lived experiences and wisdom work in their favor. When you're younger, you think that you're 60. I'm just going to stop and not do anything, said Hamby, who is also a photographer. Life is just beginning at 60, 70, and 80. Their travels around the world are documented in a joint memoir, Here We Go, Lessons for Living Fearlessly from Two Traveling Nanas, which was published in September 2025. Together, the grandmothers have visited over 50 countries on all seven continents and have no plans to slow down. They're living proof that adventure can come at any age. A friendship forged. In a way, Hamby and Hazlip were fated to become travel buddies. They met on an international trip. It was over 20 years ago, during a medical mission to Zambia that Hamby had organized and where Hazlip was one of the doctors. If you can go to Zambia and sleep out in the bush in a tent with no running water, no electricity, then you can travel anywhere, said Hamby. About 5 years later, the women grew closer. At the time, Hazlip spent two nights a week at Hamby's house because she took a medical director's job at a nearby geriatric clinic. Then Hamby lost her husband in an accident, and she turned to Hazlip, whose own husband just died years ago from illness. They bonded over grief during late night drinking coffee and talking. Or, as Hamby put it, one chapter closed and another one opened. It was during one of these chats that Hazlip mentioned she always wanted to ride the Trans-Siberian Railway, the longest in the world that crosses the expanse of Russia. Hamby didn't hesitate to say yes. The two embarked on their adventure in 2008, even having what they believe was an encounter with the KGB when their empty train car was stopped and a mysterious man interrogated them. They took it in stride, stayed calm, and discovered that they were compatible as travel companions. We weren't sitting there wringing our hands and crying. Actually, it was sort of an adventure, said Hazlip. She added that her career in emergency rooms have helped her stay calm in stressful situations, and the two also benefit from Hamby's experience directing medical missions. Their friends point out how they're different from each other, with Hamby saying she's made of spice, but balanced by her friend who is more sugar. They even set aside solo time on their trips, like if Hamby wants to zip line in New Zealand, Hazlip will relax with a cup of coffee. At the end of the day, seeing the world with their best friend has been priceless. It really has been fun to share it together, being the same age and never having a clue that any of this would ever happen, said Hamby. Adventure at any age. Just before 2020, the duo decided to plan their biggest trip yet, to celebrate turning 80. Travel around the world in 80 days, inspired by the Jules Verne novel, Around the World in 80 Days. They had everything booked and ready to go, but the COVID-19 pandemic postponed their travels. In January 2023, the women finally embarked on their worldwide exploration, hitting all seven continents, including the seven wonders of the world. They visited Portugal, Japan, Easter Island, Antarctica, and more, and they did it all on their own. We did everything ourselves, said Hamby. No travel agents, no one going with us. We carried our own luggage, and we met friends. For seniors, travel is more than just fun. It can support active aging and improve their well-being. Research supports that navigating new places and meeting new people can contribute to positive emotions and higher self-esteem. Their independence and the way they embrace the unknown struck a chord online. Even though the women weren't trying to become viral or famous, people became interested in their story once they started sharing their travels on TikTok. To the women, their age was never a limiting factor. We always say if we'd rather fall off the mountaintop than fall out of a bed at a nursing home, provided we have a choice, said Hamby. Keep moving. Once you stop moving, your body shuts down. And they're still on the move, even with 4 artificial knees and 1 hip replacement between them, as Hayslip jokes. They're currently returning to each continent for an entire month, taking the time to dive into destinations they didn't spend enough time in. In Asia, they'll hone in on Southeast Asia, such as Bhutan and Laos. It really is about saying yes, said Hamby. Adventure has no age limit. Our next headline, religion crossing political highway. More Democrats tout faith in key red states. This is written by Sarah D. Wire. Kansas City area pastor Adam Hamilton had preached about morals and ethics for decades. I have called our congregation to look at the community and say, what doesn't look the way it's supposed to look, he told USA Today. Hamilton has also taught that people who love Jesus and try to live out our faith should be involved when they see poverty, injustice, and racism. But over the last year and a half, what I found coming out of Washington was an assault on the values that I've preached for the last 36 years, he said. Earlier this month, Kansas Democrats selected him as their nominee to challenge incumbent Republican Senator Roger Marshall. For years, Republicans have had a lock on those who base their vote on religious preferences and values, something that has only grown with the rise of the evangelical right. But this year, an unusually high number of Democratic candidates in red states are sharing their faith in an effort to connect with voters in the midterm elections. Many of the campaigns have devolved into arguments about the proper interpretation of theology and scripture, as well as the role people of faith and the government should play in shaping society. At the root is debate about what it means to be a Christian in America. This is according to experts. The debate contrasts traditional conservative values, including protecting the unborn and preserving the nation's Judeo-Christian heritage, against liberal values that embrace a society made up of people of different religions and backgrounds. Many of the Democratic candidates come from more liberal or mainstream denominations. Hamilton is the founding pastor of Church of the Resurrection, which describes itself as the largest United Methodist church in the United States. He said he started it for people who didn't go to church anywhere, for people who maybe had been turned off by faith altogether, and to let them know you didn't have to check your brain at the door of the church, and that it was okay to ask questions and have doubts. Well, it's been more than 90 years since a Democrat was picked to represent the ruby red state of Kansas in the U.S. Senate. Though the Cook Political Report changed its prediction for this year's race after Hamilton won the primary from solid Republican to likely Republican, meaning it has moved into a slightly more competitive position. Marshall's campaign did not return a request for comment. Attack ads. Days after the primary, Main Street Fund, a new Massachusetts-based super political action committee, launched a commercial casting Hamilton as way too woke for Kansas. The ad splices together quotes from 2 sermons Hamilton delivered in 2020 about climate change and the mass Black Lives Matter protests after George Floyd's death. A slew of right-leaning and religious publications have since delved into his extensive sermons and writings. Hamilton said he expected his sermons and writings to be dissected when he entered the campaign. Still, he hopes people will read the full text and watch the sermons online, not just the clips. They've taken three words from one paragraph, and then they grab three words from another paragraph, two from another, and then they sew them together, and they put them into a commercial, making me say something that I never actually said, he said. Hamilton said his sermons are in line with beliefs held by the Catholic Church, mainline Christian faiths, and some evangelical houses of worship. It's easy for them to take a line or two out of context, but I really hope when people listen to those lines, they're going to go, "Oh, I want to go back and listen to the whole sermon." And when they do, I think they're going to find that what I preached is consistent with Scripture, and it actually makes a lot of sense to most people. Will it work? It's difficult to quantify how many Democratic candidates are placing faith in the center of their campaigns. Some have faith-based careers. Others talk frequently about their personal faith, but not through a partisan lens. Democrats' coalition of voters tends to be the most religiously diverse, but also the most secular, said David Campbell, director of the Notre Dame University Democracy Initiative. Democrats actually have to walk a line between attracting those moderately religious voters that are certainly inclined to vote Democratic without alienating the more secular base, said Campbell. His research has also shown that secular voters don't mind Democratic candidates talking about religion, but do mind when Republicans do. For years, Republican candidates have successfully woven their faith into their campaign strategies, said Daniel Williams, who teaches history at Ashland University in Ohio. And black Democrats, who are used to their churches talking about the intersection of faith and politics, have been vocal as well, he said. It's only been recently that we've seen the Democratic Party experimenting with the idea of having religiously devout white Christians talking very publicly about the connection between their faith and progressive policies. And we'll see how that experiment works, said Williams. What's changed? The electoral map. I think that the Democrats have realized that they have gotten into a situation where the electoral math has locked them out of being very competitive in a number of conservative-leaning states. And so the question has been, what is going to change the electoral math? There's a hope among some Democrats who have been locked out of any prospect of winning a statewide race for some time that perhaps this might be the key to winning over a few swing voters. Because many Democratic candidates come from more liberal denominations, they might struggle to break into the traditional Republican electorate in socially conservative red states, he said. The division between mainline or liberal Protestants and evangelical Protestants on cultural issues is significantly greater today than it was in the 1970s or 80s, said Williams. There's a fair amount of distance between their policies and the way that they think about the world and the way that the conservative white evangelical Republicans have traditionally thought about the world. Republicans say it's fair to point out how the candidates interpret their religion if they plan to base policy on it. Democrats are so lost when it comes to talking to Christians that they think the answer is to say God is transgender, Satanism is okay, and pagan witchcraft should be embraced. Only the coastal elite puppet masters of the Democratic Party could possibly be so out of touch to think running woke caricatures of Christian appeals to hardworking Americans, said Republican National Committee spokesman Zaft Kraft. Democrats say questioning a candidate's faith is not acceptable. Democrats are proud to have candidates of every background, including faith leaders who are bringing their authentic voice to the campaign trail and fighting for their communities. It's shameful and absurd that Republican officials are questioning someone's faith simply because they're a Democrat. Faith is not a political test, said Democratic National Committee spokeswoman Daniela Campos Lopez. Key races in Iowa. In Iowa's 3rd Congressional District, Democratic State Senator and Lutheran Minister Sarah Trone Garriott is challenging Republican U.S. Representative Zach Nunn. Republicans are attacking Trone Garriott's faith, labeling her a so-called minister, and questioning her Christian credibility over her support for LGBTQ plus rights and critiques of Christian nationalism. The race is one of the nation's top battleground matchups in the 2026 midterm elections. The RNC has asked, is Sarah Trone Garriott a witch, calling her the Wicked Witch of Woke. Nunn's campaign did not respond for a request for comment. Trone Garriott told the Des Moines Register, part of the U.S. Today network, the attacks are unlikely to stick with voters in a community where she has long woven her faith into her public service. I live that out in a way that respects my neighbors who have different beliefs and stand up for the rights of my neighbors who see the world differently than me and really centers the dignity of all my constituents, said Trone Garriott. And that is, I think, a fulfillment of my faith. As I said, that calling to love God and love my neighbor. There is no one who is not my neighbor. In Iowa's 2nd Congressional District race, State Representative Lindsey James, a college campus chaplain, is facing off against Republican former State Representative Joe Mitchell. James has experienced Republican attacks centered on her legislative record, pointing to her support for LGBTQ rights and gender-affirming care for minors as evidence that her politics are out of step with her religious background. The criticism has focused on a 2023 speech she gave against a bill prohibiting gender transition procedures for minors, in which she said, "When has protecting children meant denying them what can be a life-saving care? If you're a pastor and think that six-year-olds can change their gender, then I don't think you're much of a pastor," said Mitchell in a statement. At the Family Leadership Summit in Des Moines in July, Mitchell took aim at both James and Trone Garriott. "They're not real pastors, right? They don't profess the true gospel of Jesus Christ," said Mitchell. James, a Presbyterian, said the criticism has been extremely disappointing. "It's not just insulting to me as a pastor. It's insulting to every Christian and pastor that serves communities in this district, in this state, and across the country," she said. Texas focus on scripture. Texas U.S. Senate hopeful James Tallarico, a Presbyterian studying to become a minister, faces similar criticism on how he interprets scripture. Tallarico faces Republican nominee Ken Paxton, the state's longtime attorney general. Tallarico's campaign did not respond to requests for comment. He has made the New Testament's command to love thy neighbor a centerpiece of his campaign. "Scripture says you can't love God and hate other people," said Tallarico in a sermon posted on TikTok in December 2025. "You can't love God and abuse the immigrant. You can't love God and bully the outcast. You can't love God and oppress the poor. We spend so much time looking for God out there that we miss God in the person sitting right next to us, in that neighbor who bears the divine image. In the face of a neighbor, we glimpse the face of God," he said. Paxton's stump speeches routinely allege Tallarico's liberal theology doesn't reflect scripture. He first drew attention to a past remark that sparked backlash, in which Tallarico referred to God as a non-binary. In Tallarico's twisted version of Christianity, a follower of Christ is required to bend the knee at the altar of the radical trans agenda, disavow the oil and gas industry, support late-term abortion, and open the door to every criminal illegal immigrant seeking asylum. "Well, I'm still looking through the Bible to find those passages, but I wouldn't call it Christian," said Paxton campaign spokeswoman Madison Searcy. In May, Tallarico told CBS News' Ed O'Keefe he was being intentionally provocative with that statement. He accuses Paxton of intentionally clipping my cringy comments. Polling over the last 3 months showed Tallarico and Paxton neck and neck. And on August 20, the Cook Political Report moved the race from its leans Republican category to toss-up. A changing perspective. Rob Ryersee grew up in Christian nationalism and spent the first 10 years of his career as a pastor in a fundamentalist Baptist church. Overnight, his interpretation of scripture changed. "I woke up one day and it was like the answers I was given no longer made sense," he said. Shortly after, he moved south to Arkansas with his wife and started a non-denominational church, where he has preached for the last 20 years. After watching the rise of Christian nationalism within the Republican Party in Washington, D.C., he decided it was time to enter politics. He challenged incumbent Republican Representative Steve Womack in Northwest Arkansas in 2018 as a Republican. This year, he's a Democratic nominee challenging Womack. I wanted to be a pastor who stands up and says, no, no, no. There's a much different way to integrate faith and politics, and it is not that, he said. Womack declined to comment. The Cook Political Report rates the race as solid Republican. Faith can motivate action, but it shouldn't be the basis for the nation's laws, said Ryersey. Instead, he said, the basis should be what's best for everyone. That message has resonated with voters, he added. I'm not running to take America back for Democratic Jesus, he said. It's not like a progressive version of Christian nationalism. I'm running because my faith motivates me personally. But the Bible is not the basis for laws. Also on the front page of the USA Today, we have this story. Crackdown on kratom is weak, say critics. Some say HHS effort is good, but not enough. This is written by Charles Trepanny. When Kim Maloney saw the news conference, she said she was so happy she nearly cried. It was July 2025, and Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and then Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Marty Makary announced their plan to initiate the process to have 7-hydroxymetrogenine, also known as 7-OH, a compound naturally occurring in the kratom plant, scheduled as an illicit substance. It's an issue that hits close to home for the Ohio mother. For years, she struggled with a debilitating kratom addiction, one that eventually saw her drinking upwards of 10 kratom drinks a day. After trying one from a local CBD store in 2021. Her addiction to this hippie heroin, as one addict described it to USA Today at the time, took nearly everything from her, her car, her house, her marriage, nearly half her body weight. At one point, she weighed 70 pounds. Maloney believes her addiction would have taken her life, too, had she not gone to rehab in 2024. So when Kennedy and Makary announced federal action against synthetic 7-OH, a version of the compound artificially altered to become more potent, she saw it as a silver lining. Maybe the tide on kratom was finally about to turn. But a year later, she and other recovering addicts say they aren't so sure about that. Though they applaud the federal government for getting the ball rolling on 7-OH, they're disappointed that federal regulation hasn't yet extended to natural leaf kratom products as well, which are still sold at gas stations, liquor stores, and smoke shops across the country. This past July, HHS commended the Drug Enforcement Administration's notices of intent to temporarily schedule 7-OH and three of its derivatives as illicit substances, but said the actions are not intended to regulate natural leaf kratom that does not contain enhanced levels of 7-OH. At the 2025 news conference, Makary was asked if the federal government planned to also go after natural leaf kratom, which remains legal in most states. There have been physicians who have had concerns about some claims around natural kratom, said Makary. We have to prioritize what we work on. So we're going after the killer first, which is the synthetic concentrated kratom. And then we can look into the other question. But we think it's night and day in terms of the public health risk. USA Today has reached out to the HHS and the DEA for further comment. Though synthetic, 7-OH is far more potent and addictive than natural leaf kratom. Experts say both substances pose a risk for addiction. For Maloney and others who know the risk firsthand, going after one and not the other gets at only part of the problem. They need to go after all of it, said Maloney. Things like this should not be sold at a gas station. 7-OH and the dangers of kratom. In 2025, USA Today spoke with more than 20 people, including Maloney, who said they became severely addicted to kratom. Many of these people had no history of substance abuse before ingesting kratom. Some were health fitness enthusiasts who thought kratom was just like any other wellness supplement. Others thought it was a healthy alternative to alcohol. A few mistook it for run-of-the-mill caffeine drink, like coffee or tea. Many also said they used only natural leaf kratom and never touched synthetic 7-OH. Natural leaf products come in many forms, some as capsules, some as powders, and others as drinks. In July 2025, one product went viral when a TikToker posted a video describing how a teenage boy tried stealing his wallet outside a gas station after he refused to buy the boy a feel-free tonic. At the time, a representative for Botanic Tonics, the company behind Feel Free, told USA Today its Feel Free Classic Tonic contains only natural leaf kratom, with nearly undetectable levels of 7-OH. USA Today has reached out to a representative for Botanic Tonics for additional comment. In online support groups, stories abound of people who say they fell into devastating addiction shortly after trying natural leaf kratom. "It's like the same names, the anonymous names over and over," said Maloney of a Reddit group for people trying to quit Feel Free. The product, she says, hooked her. "This is my 12th quit. I can't quit. Somebody help. It's constant. The same people over and over. It's heartbreaking." Dr. Timothy Fong, president of the American Academy of Addiction Psychiatry, said that while it's clear synthetic 7-OH is far more powerful and dangerous than its natural leaf products, lack of standardized regulations has muddied the waters for consumers. "It's kind of like caffeine and nicotine and alcohol," said Fong. "If I buy a Red Bull in New York and in L.A., I know it's the same content. If I buy a Starbucks latte in New York and L.A., it's going to be the same. If I buy a bag of natural leaf kratom, I have no idea if it's exactly the same in terms of purity, contaminants, because these products are not regulated." Still, pro-kratom advocates say it's possible to consume natural leaf kratom responsibly, and that many do so for pain relief. Many also take issue with natural leaf products getting conflated with the 7-OH ones. Mac Haddow, a senior fellow on public policy at the American Kratom Association, is one of those advocates. He says he's used natural leaf kratom for 10 years to treat his knee and back pain as well as arthritis. "When I was young and stupid, I raced motorcycles in the desert when I was in college, and I banged myself up pretty good, and I'm paying the price for it now," he says. "So I use it on a daily basis just to fend off the pain that's associated with that, and it helps." Yet many who struggled with kratom addiction say the risks far outweigh the benefits. Ginny Schmidt, a nurse who says she became addicted to Feel Free, says she sees both sides. "The government is right to distinguish botanical kratom leaf from highly concentrated or semi-synthetic 7-OH products," she said. "They're not interchangeable. Lumping them together is scientifically sloppy and could hurt people who have responsibly used traditional leaf or powder for pain or to move away from more dangerous substances. But pretending botanical kratom can't cause dependence is also dishonest." But Maloney said natural leaf kratom almost killed her. She's gotten pushback for wanting more regulation, but says she'll keep speaking out if doing so spares others that fate. "People have come after me and said, 'Oh, you're nothing but an addict. Why are you trying to get rid of something so good?' And I'm like, 'It ruined my life.' Either you're a full-blown addict or you're delusional because you didn't live with my experience." Our next headline, families of USS Lincoln crew irate at Trump and Hegseth. They say official denials of issues are frustrating. This is written by Chris Quintana. A senior Navy machinist aboard the USS Abraham Lincoln pinged a family group chat in early May, asking her sister and mother whether they'd taken time off to be at her son's graduation at Morehouse. Getting the 22-year-old kinesiology major through college has taken a fair amount of fussing, cursing, and plenty of headaches. But it seemed like he'd finally made it to the finish line, and there was cause for celebration. The combat with Iran was dragging along. Internet service aboard the carrier was unreliable, said the machinist. Graduation is in 12 days, and sadly, I may not even get to see pics of my boy on one of the most important days of his life, she wrote. This was one of my biggest fears, not to be here for him at a time like this. Tamika Kyles, the older sister of the machinist aboard the Lincoln, nearly cried as she shared details of her sister's deployment with a USA Today reporter. She said her sister joined the military to provide a better life for her son. It wasn't supposed to be like this, said Kyles. The Lincoln was scheduled to return in May, and the graduation was later that same month. In the weeks before the group chat message, President Donald Trump had said multiple times that the conflict with Iran seems to be winding down. Instead, her sister and thousands of other service members have remained on board for 3 additional months. Kyles and another family member who spoke with USA Today both requested anonymity for their loved ones for fear of reprisal. On August 20, the United States Central Command announced that the USS George Washington had arrived in the Arabian Sea to take the next turn as an aircraft carrier in the Iran war. Several media outlets reported the same day that the Lincoln was heading back to San Diego. USA Today reported in April on conditions aboard the Lincoln and the USS Tripoli, also deployed to the Middle East. A photo shared with USA Today reporter showed a small handful of boiled carrots, a dry meat patty, and a slab of gray processed meat from a meal on the Lincoln. The change in warships come after a fresh barrage of reporting about diminishing food supplies, a lack of hygiene products, and declining mental health for service members who've been on board the Lincoln since November 2025. Outlets including Stars and Stripes and Military Times reported that crew members were struggling with their mental health and some had tried to jump off the ship. The crew still faces weeks on the water after spending more than 200 days without a port visit. It's one of the longest stretches for personnel on a modern aircraft carrier. Pentagon Chief Pete Hegseth and President Donald Trump both pushed back on accounts of substandard conditions on the carrier, calling the reports overblown or outright false. Parents, siblings, and spouses have expressed frustration with the administration's remarks on social media and to media outlets. The high-profile denials were frustrating and even enraging to families, such as Kyle's, who have seen what life on the warship looks like and heard detailed accounts of the challenges their loved ones faced during their protracted deployment. She told USA Today she was especially upset when Trump stated on August 14 that families were not concerned about their relatives, adding that in his view, the deployment had not gone on nearly long enough. How about you bring your family out there, suggested Kyles, recalling her immediate response to the president's seemingly flippant remark. How about you go out there and try and tell us how it feels? The White House did not respond specifically to questions about the president's remarks or conditions that families mentioned on the ship. However, Anna Kelly, a White House spokesperson, said the president had restored a focus on readiness, lethality, and reporting our war fighters at the Pentagon after years of failure by the Biden administration. The president cares about our troops more than anyone, and he is ensuring our brave service members have all the resources they need to be successful as the United States military continues to economically strangle the Iranian regime, said Kelly to USA Today. Senator Richard Blumenthal, ranking member of the Veterans Affairs Committee and member of the Armed Services Committee, told USA Today he had heard dramatically and directly accounts about shortages of food, clean water, and other necessities like toothpaste and soap on the Lincoln. The mental stress of not knowing when the deployment would end, along with those conditions, has imposed really serious anguish and anxiety, he said. red velvet cake, but no happy surprises. Christy McGarry's family often worries about the impact of what he felt. About the impact of what has felt like an unending deployment on her 22-year-old son. He worked as a cook on the Lincoln and now works in the aircraft carrier's shipping department. He surprised her during his freshman year of college when he told her he wanted to quit school and join the Navy. They're not a military family, but he argued it would give him money to pay for his education without racking up student loan debt. She swallowed her concerns and supported his ambitions. At first, she had no reason to worry, she said. During his first deployment aboard the USS Abraham Lincoln, he texted and called with regularity and seemed upbeat. But the current deployment felt different almost immediately, she said. For one thing, they could go up to a month or two without any contact, as opposed to the weekly calls she was accustomed to on the last deployment. He was frustrated, she said, but the ship hadn't been to a port without explanation. McGarry said she, too, had been concerned about her son, and the president doesn't get to tell me how I feel about that. What really seemed to get to her son was the crew's ever-changing return date, she said. His sister was getting married in June, and they had assumed, based on what commanding officers originally indicated, he would be back with plenty of time to attend her garden wedding in the mountains of Colorado. But the day came and went, with son crammed into his quarters on the ship while his older brother and other family members danced at the wedding. His mom recalled they ate red velvet cake, a favorite of her son's. The bride, a mother hen to her younger brother, had hoped until the last moment he might make an appearance. I think she really thought I was going to surprise her, said McGarry, and it was going to be one of those Facebook moments. Well, it wasn't. Shipmates' accounts of crew member who went overboard. Living like this has had other real consequences for service members aboard the ship. Kyle said her sister, the senior machinist, had lost about 10 to 15 pounds. The senior machinist also said there were points when she ran out of soap or laundry detergent. Kyle's once saw what the food looks like during a video call. What the machinist showed her, she said, looked like slop that people wouldn't feed to a dog. McGarry shared texts in which her son wrote the ship had been without hot water in an apparent attempt, he wrote, to encourage crew members to keep their showers short. When he spoke with her in mid-August, he told her the toilets break down and stay unrepaired for far too long. Kyle's also said it took 3 to 4 months for packages to reach her sister. McGarry's son told his mom not to bother sending packages because people weren't receiving them. Blumenthal told USA Today he was concerned about unreliable package delivery, describing mail as an important link between families and their loved ones. I've said to people, a stale cookie in a care package is worth its weight in gold, he said. You know someone you loved baked it. As a morale booster, it's invaluable, and the lack of it is a kind of a sign of abandonment. McGarry told her son in mid-August that there had been reports of people going overboard, but he pushed back and said it had only been one. Kyle's also shared texts where her sister mentioned that someone had jumped, though she said he was wearing a life vest. After two military trade publications reported that sailors had tried to jump off the ship in early August, U.S. Central Command released an August 13 statement saying that one sailor who fell overboard August 3 was quickly and safely recovered. Acting Secretary of the Navy Hong Chao said in an August 14 statement that members of the media are trying to paint our warriors as victims. He also said a small number of mental health cases were treated, but no one died. Meals were adjusted when fresh resupply was unavailable, the statement said, and calls home were limited when the operational threat was too high. Democratic lawmakers have pressed the federal government since mid-August to provide answers about the conditions aboard the Lincoln. They're seeking a firm timeline for a return to home or return to port date for the carrier and requesting a bipartisan congressional delegation to visit the carrier. As the USS George Washington reached the Middle East days ago to take the place of the Lincoln, Family members praised loved ones, but Blumenthal said he didn't think the experience would be much different for service members, and he feared the same conditions might crop up again. I have yet to be convinced that they have significantly improved the means and routes to supply the George Washington any better than they did with the Lincoln, he said. Our next story, backlash greets plan to reduce beef prices. Cattlemen and politicians see more harm in move. This is written by Joey Garrison. President Donald Trump said he will ease tariffs on up to 300,000 metric tons of ground beef imported into the United States for the next 90 days in a bid to reduce the prices Americans are paying for the grocery staple ahead of the November midterm election. Trump, in an August 21 post on Truth Social, said he reached a deal for foreign ground beef exporters to sell their product at a 25% discount in exchange for not paying U.S. out-of-quota tariffs on foreign beef. The president is expected to sign an executive order within the next 2 weeks formalizing the move. This is according to a White House official. This deal will reduce prices for Americans while giving space for our great American beef herd to grow again, said Trump. The price of beef and veal was up 9.4% in the United States in July over the previous year. This is according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, as year-over-year inflation eased slightly from June. Stubborn inflation poses a major challenge politically for Trump and Republicans as they look to maintain control of Congress. Trump's move comes as imported beef into the United States has increased dramatically, up 122% in 5 years, according to the American Farm Bureau Federation. As the supply of domestic cattle remains as multi-decade lows, following years of drought and the spread of the parasitic New World screwworm near the Mexican border and other factors. The National Cattlemen's Beef Association criticized Trump's action. While America's cattle producers share the goal of keeping groceries affordable for consumers, flooding the market with government-subsidized, below-market beef is not the way to rebuild the American cattle herd, said the group in a statement. Under the tariff quota system, varying amounts of imported beef from each country can be imported into the United States at substantially lower tariffs before higher out-of-quota tariffs apply. A May report from the American Farm Bureau Federation said U.S. beef imports entering under quota generally face a tariff of just 4.4 cents per kilogram, while imports above quota face a 26.4% tariff. A White House official who discussed the move on the condition of anonymity said Trump's deal on ground beef is intended to be short-term, to fill a gap to meet consumer demand. The Trump administration will simultaneously work with ranchers to expand domestic beef production for the long term, said the official. It was not immediately clear which countries Trump had struck a deal with. The president declined to say which nations were part of the agreement during a question and answer session with reporters later in the day. But Senator Tim Sheehy, Republican from Montana, a Trump ally from one of the nation's largest cattle states, said he urged the president not to take the action, saying it will further harm ranchers, most of whom are MAGA Republicans. The president's heart is in the right place on wanting lower prices for the American people, and beef prices have been impacted by the Mexican screwworm, wrote Sheehy in a post on X. But the reality is this action will make it more difficult for American ranchers to rebuild our herd and bring prices down for the American people. Senator Deb Fischer, Republican from Nebraska, another state where ranching is central to its economy, said she's extremely disappointed by Trump's decision. We all want lower grocery prices, but as I've said for months, we cannot do it at the expense of American producers. Flooding the market with foreign beef hurts our livestock industry and undermines the long-term solution that growing the U.S. cattle herd to meet demand, said Fischer. Asked about the criticism by ranchers on August 21, Trump defended the intervention and invoked the midterms. We want to get the beef prices down, he said. That's what people want. That's what voters want. And that's what I want. Well, it's time now to turn to the money section of the USA Today. Our lead story, lucky no more. The Magnificent Seven are slipping. Don't let them degrade your 401k. This is written by Daniel D. Vizet. In recent years, the tech giants known as the Magnificent Seven have been the toast of Wall Street. Between 2015 and 2024, the seven stocks collectively earned an eye-popping 698%, nearly four times the return for the S&P 500 as a whole. This is according to the Motley Fool. Lately, though, the seven's performance has looked positively pedestrian. In the first half of 2026, Vanguard reports, the Magnificent Seven actually declined in value, losing 1% in a span that saw the S&P as a whole rise by 9%. The Magnificent Seven used to move more or less in lockstep, mostly going up. Now they're scattered across the proverbial prairie. Chipmaker NVIDIA is up roughly 18% on the year as of August 18. Apple, maker of the Mac and iPhone, is up 14%. Amazon, the e-commerce giant, is up 13%. Alphabet, holding company for Google, is up about 10%. Microsoft, the firm behind Windows, is basically flat for the year. Meta, parent of Facebook, is down 17%. And Tesla, the EV automaker, is down 25%. There's only one Mag 7 that's beating the market this year, and it's NVIDIA, said Chris G. Grisanti, chief market strategist at MAI Capital Management. Only NVIDIA has reaped returns well beyond the S&P, which is up roughly 12.5% this year. The Magnificent Seven came together for a period of time, said Grisanti, and now they're separating. Here's how the Magnificent Seven got its name. The Seven saw dramatic growth over the past decade and all rank among the world's largest companies by market value. Bank of America analyst Michael Hartnett coined the term Magnificent Seven in 2023 to encompass the tech giants, a group that powered a phenomenal run on the U.S. stock market. Apart from being hot stocks, however, the seven never had that much in common. Amazon sells consumer products. Google is a search engine. Meta dominates social media. Microsoft makes software. And Tesla makes cars. If the Magnificent Seven moniker ever really fit, said Grisanti, maybe its time has passed. I think that's a useful term only in the rearview mirror. Some Magnificent Seven stocks have shed value. Various Magnificent Seven stocks have shed value for a myriad of reasons. Tesla plummeted in 2025 as CEO Elon Musk plunged into politics as a controversial advisor to President Donald Trump. Microsoft sank this year amid a broader decline of software stocks. Meta has swooned as the company fights litigation, alleging that the firm seeded addictive behavior in children. A broader narrative suggests investors are questioning the massive artificial intelligence investments by the Magnificent Seven, and particularly by the AI hyperscalers, a group said to include Alphabet, Amazon, Meta, and Microsoft. Together, the firms are spending more than $700 billion this year on AI infrastructure. At the end of the day, the bill will come due, said Roger Aliga-Diaz, global head of portfolio construction at Vanguard. And what investors will start asking in earnings calls is all the money you spent going to pay off? Well, those firms are competing for memory chips and electrical capacity to expand AI. Prices are rising for those items, and some investors are bailing on Mag 7 stocks in favor of the companies that supply them. Is the Magnificent Seven's run nearing its end? Throughout the Seven's tremendous run, stock analysts have debated how long it might last. Vanguard, among others, predicted in 2025 that the Magnificent Seven would rise only modestly in value over the next decade. The key reason, most of the Seven stocks were overpriced. Economists measure the value of a stock by a formula called the cyclically adjusted price to earnings, or CAPE, ratio. It tells you, in effect, whether the stock is overvalued or undervalued. Well, right now, the CAPE, or CAPE, ratio for the S&P 500 stands at 42.35. That means stock prices are very expensive relative to earnings. Most of the Magnificent Seven stocks have higher price-to-earnings ratio than the market as a whole. In other words, they are relatively overpriced. Stock forecasters are also concerned about market concentration. Together, the Mag 7 make up 34% of the value of the S&P 500, according to a Motley Fool analysis. Back in 2015, by contrast, the 7 represented only 12% of the S&P. The U.S. market overall has become very top-heavy, said Philip Strahl, Chief Investment Officer, Americas, for Morningstar Wealth. Concentration is the opposite of diversification. Investors are told not only to hold stocks, to hold only stocks, and not to hold too much of any one stock. Perhaps unwittingly, a casual investor who tries to diversify with an S&P 500 index fund is staking a third of their investment in the Magnificent Seven. You're buying into the S&P 500 to diversify, right? But you still end up with this very specific group, said Anders Bylund, contributing media and technology analyst to Motley Fool. Well, here are some tips for diversifying beyond the Magnificent Seven. Fortunately, there are other ways to diversify, and here's a few places to look. Value stocks. A value stock is a good deal, basically, trading at a relatively low price relative to sales and earnings. Vanguard expects value stocks to rise by 6.4% to 8.4% a year over the next decade. Small cap stocks. Small cap stocks are shares in smaller companies. Vanguard predicts small cap stocks to rise 4.7 to 6.7% annually over the next 10 years. And non-U.S. stocks. Foreign stocks beat U.S. stocks in 2025, and many analysts still consider them a good bet in 2026. Bylund and other analysts are not suggesting investors should sell all of their shares in the Magnificent Seven. Motley Fool still lists Amazon, Alphabet, and Apple among its top 10 stocks to buy and hold. Yet market forecasters may be less likely in the future to romanticize the Magnificent Seven, such as the gunfighters in the namesake 1960 movie, riding off together into the sunset. Bylund jokingly urges investors to remember the ultimate fate of the seven in the film. Four of them die by the end. Our next headline, Idaho leads survey of best states to live in. Wallet Hub uses five keys to find the best and worst. This is written by Gabe Howery. Well, how good is your state to live in? Wallet Hub recently released its latest ranking of all 50 states to identify which states are the best and worst to live in. The personal finance website said it compared all 50 states across five key categories: affordability, economy, education and health, quality of life, and safety. Those dimensions were then evaluated using 51 relevant metrics, with each metric graded on a 100-point scale. When deciding on a place to move, you should first consider financial factors like the cost of living, housing prices, and job availability, said Chris Lupo, a Wallet Hub analyst quoted on the study. Many states have strong economies, though, so you should also consider a wide variety of other factors, such as how where you live will impact your health and safety, and whether you'll have adequate access to activities that you enjoy. Well, here's what Wallet Hub study found. What are the best states to live in? According to Wallet Hub, the five best states to live in are: number one, Idaho; 2, New Jersey. 3, Wisconsin. 4, Massachusetts. 5, New Hampshire. Idaho ranked highly in the affordability, economy, and safety categories, while New Jersey was highly rated for its education and health, quality of life, and safety categories. Massachusetts was the number one ranked state when it comes to education and health, while New Hampshire was in top 4 in 3 categories, economy, education, health, and safety. The 5 worst states to live in, according to WalletHub, are Arkansas, Alaska, Mississippi, Louisiana, and New Mexico. The full rankings and methodology can be found on WalletHub's website. Next, we have Trump urges Fed to cut interest rates again. Members of committee remain wary of inflation. This is written by Rachel Barber. President Donald Trump again pressured the Federal Reserve to lower its benchmark for interest rates, insisting rates are artificially high, the same day the Treasury Department announced the U.S. national debt surpassed $40 trillion, though many forecasters are still predicting the Fed will hold its target range steady at its next meeting in September. Though the president said Fed Chair Kevin Warsh, whom he nominated to the position this year, is doing a great job, he implied other members of the rate-setting committee may have political motives when casting their votes. Trump consistently criticized former Fed Chair Jerome Powell for the same reason after nominating him to the role in 2017. Powell remains on the committee as a governor. He and other committee members, including Warsh, have repeatedly affirmed their independence from politics. The problem is he has a board, and it's a political board, said Trump to reporters on August 19 while speaking alongside crypto executives at the White House. People put in by Obama, Biden, and me, and there are quite a few members still left, as you understand. And so they vote to raise interest rates. I don't know if they're doing it because they think they're doing a good thing or because they like the politics of it. The Federal Open Market Committee as a whole has not voted to raise the federal funds rate since July 2023. It voted to lower the rate 3 times late last year and has held it steady so far in 2026. At its most recent meeting in July, 3 committee members dissented from the decision, preferring to raise the target range by a quarter point. The federal funds rate still stands at a range of 3.5% to 3.75%. My point is, years ago, 25 years ago, when the country announced good numbers, interest rates went down because we had a stronger country, said Trump. Well, now, when we announce good numbers, the better they are, the worse it is for interest rates. The Fed considers a wider array of economic data when making its interest rate decisions. The committee typically raises the federal funds rate to tame inflation and lowers it when it's concerned about slowing in the job market. A higher federal funds rate often means consumers face higher interest rates on things such as credit cards, personal loans, and car loans, while savers benefit from higher returns on high-yield savings accounts and certificates of deposit. A lower federal funds rate generally produces the opposite effect. In either case, it does not directly affect mortgage rates. The 30-year fixed rate for mortgages tends to track the trajectory of the 10-year U.S. Treasury note. Well, that wraps up today's news from USA Today. I'm Laura Kerrigan, a volunteer reader for the Talking Information Center Network. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.